Come with us on a journey into the unknown, the unexplained, and the unbelievable. We will test your senses and challenge your beliefs. A world where science and religion clash. Or do they? You will meet real people and hear real stories, but you will not believe. You will witness strange sights and hear strange sounds, but you will not believe. This is the New England Ghost Project. Welcome to the nightmare.
Well, that was the wrong opening, but what are you going to do, you know? Welcome to Ghost Chronicles Book of Shadows. I am Roy Kolick, your host, and joining me is the lovely West Coast witch, Myla Brooks.
The giggly one right now.
Yeah, so I don't know what happened on that one, but anyway, all my hard work of opening, making that opening down there.
It'll be back. I've heard anyway. It before. Yeah.
Joining us now is also a longtime ghost hunter, as long as I can remember, which is pretty long time, is author and ghost hunter Richard Sennett. Richard, you're there.
Yeah, good to be here.
Thank you. You're out in California?
Yes, I live in a little town called Ojai in the center of California, and I'm here as in this area where I grew up, and I still live in the same place where I went to school in the first grade.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's a while ago. Yeah. So is it raining out there, or is, California still there? Or is it something we have to worry about?
Well, we've had a lot of rain, but it's not raining at this very moment, which I'm thankful for.
Yeah, it's sunny over here down in L.A. also. So.
Well, L.A.,
I'm telling L.A., you. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Whatever.
You're just jealous that you don't live in California.
I live in New England. You can't beat it. You guys get all crappy weather and this and that.
Yeah, like we have snow and hurricanes and all kinds of stuff. Yeah,
hurricanes.
Right.
We don't get hurricanes. There's a little wind blowers.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And now you've had an earthquake too. So there.
We always have earthquakes, but then nothing that hurt. Then we go, we had an earthquake. That's our excitement. Nothing really happens. It's not like the place falls apart like some place.
Like down here? Yeah. Okay.
Anyway,
all right.
Still waiting it to fall off into the ocean, but
we're not falling into the ocean, but we all have life jackets anyway. Okay.
Yeah. So, Richard, you have written a bunch of books, as I guess.
Yeah, a whole bunch.
A whole bunch full. And is this your latest book that we're about to talk about?
Yeah, it's one of my more recent ones. I'm working on a new one, but the heck yeah, I'm working on books all the time. And this is the newest one. It's kind of a labor of love because I always loved the American Civil War. And I had an ancestor who fought in the Civil War and other family members who fell in the battles on the Union side, by the way. So I've always had this affinity for that particular conflict. And I've studied it quite a lot. But I found there's a lot of things that are wrong in the historic record, and that's where crypto historians come in. Now, crypto history is really looking at folklore and myth and looking at the kind of unexplained stuff about an event, and then studying to see how much the mythology is correct and how much of it is dead wrong. And remarkably, a lot of it is correct. And that's what crypto history really is.
Ah, I thought it was like, Bigfoot and Chumbawamba or whatever it is.
In biology, it is. That's pretty much the same thing. Cryptozoology is a search for mythic animals. So crypto history is a search for mythic history.
Clever.
How true it is or how untrue it is. I'm unmasking myths as well as confirming them.
That's like cryptocurrency is a search for real money.
Yeah, I imagine so.
Well, I found something really interesting right off the bat of the book.
Of course you would.
Of course. because you had vivid dreams about the conflict, Richard, and you even believed that you might have fought in the war in a past life. And but in when you were 12 years old, you were asleep on the couch as the family was watching a movie on TV, and you were told that you sat up, still asleep, gave a snappy salute, and said, "Yes, sir, General Lee."
And then we're back. I thought he fought for the North. Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Well, the past life is my family fought for the North, but who knows what I did in another life.
Do you remember? I mean, they told you about it, but did you have any, when nope. they said it?
Nope. And I did have another weird thing happen where I was, I guess I was about 16. I did an experiment, which is an old psychic experiment, where you get two candles and put them next to a mirror. And then you look, and supposedly, if you look in a darkened room with your reflection, you'll see the face you had in another life.
Huh.
So I did that, and about 20 minutes went by, and my face changed. It grew a beard, which I didn't have at the time, and a hat formed, a Confederate cap. And I looked very old at this image, and it all faded away into another face. I was a Chinese gentleman. And then the third face was a woman, and I stopped at that point. But it was, so
yeah,
maybe it had something to do with past life regressions. I've been regressed 3 times, but never into a Civil War kind of scenario. It was always something else. And it's strange stuff, but the Civil War was pretty strange in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. It was.
So when you say strange, what to you was strange about it, other than
The blood? I mean, this was the bloodiest war in all human history that we have records of, anyway. And so many died. More people died in the American Civil War than any other war previous to that. It was only exceeded by World War I, which was exceeded by World War II, which took the lives of 3% of the whole population of the earth. World War II did, but 700,000, and that's only an estimate. It's probably the number is even greater if you count civilians and people who starved to death or died of unrelated injuries after the fighting stopped. So there's a lot of... just the bloodshed alone, it was mechanized death. And you know what the biggest killer was? Shells, exploding shells. They didn't have them before. Well, they had some bombs, but shells as we know them today, it didn't exist till the Civil War. And they took many, many, many lives. Shrapnel killed more people than bullets. So it was just a nightmare.
But, you know, the bullets were a nightmare themselves because they were such a big caliber that they would tear a person. That's why there were so many amputees in the Civil War, because that's also the medical advice for the time was just simply. I mean, I did a lot of things down in Gettysburg. I have Mark Nesbitt down there was a good friend of mine. And, you know, we went to one place where they had the operating room, and there were so many bots that they just threw them out the window. It was like a huge pile of arms and legs that they had to cut off.
Yeah, it's so horrible. In fact, it was so awful that at Gettysburg, vultures came and feasted upon the dead bodies and on the arms and legs amputated. And even today, the vultures come back on the anniversary of the battle, some sort of genetic trait. They remember that feast they had back in 1863, and they keep returning to Gettysburg.
Get out.
But the only reason they cut the arms and legs off is because they had no way to fight infection. Mm-hmm. So the chances of survival were better if you had your arm or leg removed than it would have been if they tried to treat the injury and you would die of infection.
Yeah, but the bullet in itself was such a big caliber, it would shatter the bone rather than just break it.
Oh, yeah, it would. Even though black powder is a slower burning, these were rifled weapons, and they hadn't really had them before. So they had a greater range, and they were just devastating. We're talking like 50 caliber bullets.
They were called mini balls, but they weren't mini.
No, they weren't. They would do you in quite well. And unfortunately, they served very well in that capacity of just murdering people. It was horrible. And then they had old tactics where they stood up facing one another and just exchanging bullets, which worked very well in the Revolutionary War and the Napoleonic War, where the guns were so inaccurate. You know, one in five might hit someone. This, they were all accurate. So standing up like that and fighting was just almost akin to taking your chances of death. And rather than today, we would be smart and tell people, lay down, hide somewhere, get in a trench or behind a tree. No, they just stood face to face. And what gets me is so many people just did it. They were ordered, go out there, stand up and shoot. And they did, and they died in huge numbers, just like World War I, going over the top, you know, into
against machine guns.
No man's land, and getting machine gunned. It's just astounding, the amount of death and that happened. It's no wonder that so many of the battlefields are haunted.
Mm-hmm. So do you look at the hauntings at all in your book?
Oh, yes, of course. There's a whole bit are, in fact, that's what started the whole book. I was going to make a list of all the haunted battlefields and sites linked to the Civil War that are haunted, because my expertise, as you know, is ghost hunting.
Right.
So that's what started the whole operation. And Gettysburg gets a lot of attention as a haunted site, and it is. I mean, there's no shortage of sightings of ghosts there. But it's not the only one. In fact, even during the Civil War itself, battlefields were rumored to be haunted. So almost every battlefield of any major size has stories of ghosts and weird things. And you know what the most haunted area is? The old hospitals, where they chopped those arms and legs off, where so many people just died of their wounds. These old hospitals and homes and businesses that were used as hospitals are extremely haunted.
Well, I like this story about, what's his name, George Washington being seen. And he saved some people. Well, supposedly saved some people. And, you know, he was on his horse and everybody didn't realize it. And then they looked at what he was wearing and that three-point cap. And then, he was, I guess he liked the war and could do something about it, huh?
And there's also all kinds of rumors of patriots from the American Revolution showing up. There's one at which McClellan supposedly had a vision of Washington telling him how to attack Lee at one of the great battles. So now, what was it? Now, was it really Washington, or was it some guy who liked Washington, who a farmer who may have put on a tricorn hat, maybe put on a Revolutionary War uniform that perhaps his grandfather wore in that great war and led the army to the battlefield? Maybe that was what it was. There's no evidence that it really was Washington, even though the federal government did do an investigation and actually talked to people who claimed and swore up and down it was the father of our country.
Oh,
and
wow.
Of course, it makes good propaganda. Yeah, Washington supports the Union. Must be a good cause.
He went down south, yeah. No. You know, the stories, some of the stories are kind of amusing, and that's why it's crypto, because there was one story about Robert E. Lee's mother, who was thought to be dead and placed in the family tomb, And a grave robber snuck in, and he opened the casket and started to remove her diamond ring, but it didn't come off. So he had a little knife with him, and he cut off her finger, and that caused her to wake up from a coma. And it said the robber got scared, ran away with the ring and the finger.
And as she wrapped her burial shroud in her bleeding hand, got out of her coffin, and walked home where they were having this somber party for her death. They used to do that. They have like a memorial dinner and all that.
Oh,
and she pounded on the door, scared everyone to death. Anyway, that's the rumor. Now, how true it is, we don't know. Right? We do know that she was very sick when Robert E. Lee was born. That's a fact. But if she was comatose, I don't know. But it's still a great story.
It
even
was.
Though I kind of debunked it in my book.
Mm-hmm. No, I was smiling because I got in my head, here comes the guy with the finger in his hand running really fast. Yeah.
But that story
happened a lot in the old days because people were buried with their jewelry on them.
Exactly.
And people would ghoulishly go in and steal their clothing, of course, their jewelry, especially a wedding ring or something like that, and to make a living that way, you know, as a ghoulish thief. That did happen.
And there were premature burials, and there were special coffins and everything that were designed to prevent that. So it was a fear at the time. And of course,
yeah,
you know,
for a legitimate fear, too. It's kind of like another thing, that people would be resurrected, their bodies taken out and sold to medical schools to be utilized as
like,
cadavers
yeah,
for students.
Girl thieves, you know, used to did that too. That's a popular one.
So, another one was women would be, people feared that the young girls who would die would be raped by ghoulish morticians who would do that sort of thing, rape the dead bodies. And so that's why many women were buried with chastity belts on to prevent that. And of course, they weren't to be worn on a daily basis. They didn't need to worry about health hazards because the wearer was dead. But it was to keep the purity of their daughters after death.
Mm-mm-mm.
I didn't know that. That's a new one for me.
Yeah. Speaking of women, did any women fight in the Civil War?
Of course they did.
Oh, lots of them fought. They fought in many, many, many ways. Not only as soldiers, some just disguised themselves as men. Up to 500 is estimated. We'll never know for sure. Actually shouldered arms, put on the uniforms, gave themselves male names, and actually fought. In fact, one woman was a top sergeant. Was really a tough sergeant, and they only found out that she was a woman when, in the middle of a battle, she collapsed and gave birth to a baby.
Oh, geez.
And what did they? By the way, when they found these ladies, just sent them home. They said, "I'm sorry, get out of here." And there were other women who openly fought. There was a thing called a vivandière in the Union Army and in the Confederate as well. The vivandières actually served as combat medics.
Mm-hmm.
They actually went into the battlefield, and they had a little uniform with a skirt, and they carried water for the men and gave tourniquets and gave medical help to men and helped to evacuate them from the battlefield to hospitals. So they actually did fight. And were wounded, too, even though both sides agreed not to shoot them because they actually helped both the Confederate and Union fallen troops. They were non-discriminatory in that regard. Mm-hmm. And some of them got medals for their actions in the Civil War. Many were nurses. This was the first time that female nurses were used. And that had started in England with the Crimean War, and a lady named, Florence Nightingale. And she started in the the Crimean War, and they followed up with her, Clara Barton and others here in the United States. Both Union and Confederate had lots of women in the hospitals helping out. Some even became doctors, and the doctor was overwhelmed. Some of the nurses would just take on the role as doctors. So they did an awful lot. And of course, one area that they did participate in, which has been done by women since the dawn of mankind, and the dawn of war at least, and that was as prostitutes. And that's, it was during the Civil War that they got the name Hooker. That was named after Fighting Joe Hooker, who was a Union general who was known to be very aggressive. And unfortunately, he liked to use the services of the female ladies. And so they took to calling themselves Hooker's Legion. And the name has stuck ever since.
Huh. That's interesting.
So women did play a big role. In fact, some even shouldered arms as women. In the South, there was a whole militia group of women who would drill and practice with rifles, even had a little uniform to protect their town in Georgia. And when the Union soldiers finally came, they actually stood in the way to bar them from Atlanta. And the Union didn't want to shoot them, so they put out a delegation and asked them, well, what do you want? So we don't want you to loot our town. And they said, okay, if you'll step aside, we won't loot your town. That way we won't have a fight. And they called themselves the Nancy Hearts. And the Nancy Hearts retired and watched as the Union soldiers marched on to Atlanta, but they didn't loot the town, unlike most of the places in Georgia that were suffered under the Union soldiers' looting and deprivations.
Yeah, that's intriguing stuff. I mean, the Civil War brought us so many modern inventions. You know, the Huntley was the first submarine to sink a vessel. The balloons for observation were another big deal, and the ironclads, of course, how can I forget those? But there are a ton of inventions just came out of the Civil War.
Well, you'll find that case with all wars. Wars bring by inventive parts of man, and we like to invent things. We wouldn't have jet planes if it wasn't for World War II.
Fair enough.
And those TV had been invented, it didn't, it was kind of put on the back burner for a while during World War II. But all these great inventions come out of man's desire to get an edge on the enemy. And we see that even today. And what's going on in Crimea in Ukraine and in these areas, new inventions are coming up every day because of this conflict. And it's sad, but it's true. But a lot of the inventions, by the way, didn't work very well.
No,
and the Hungary invention, the submarine, was a good example. It killed more people for the Confederacy than it ever did for the Union. And it did sink one ship, but in the process it sank itself. There's still a lot of mystery about that.
And they recovered it though, which is awesome.
One of the weirdest ones I liked was a double-barreled cannon. It was a cannon with two barrels. The idea was that there would be a cannonball in each barrel, and they would be connected with a chain. And this would be fired at advancing Union troops, and then the balls would come out, and the chain would get taut, and they would roll across the battlefield and decapitate all of the enemy soldiers with the chain. Which, by the way, sounds like a great idea, right? Well, you have to fire the cannon, both barrels, at the exact same moment.
Oh, you got a problem.
It would not work. And they tested it. One cannonball fired before the other, and they started spinning around and actually killed a bunch of the people observing demonstration. So it was a complete failure. But there were many, many others, like the machine gun. They tried to make them. And the big problem they had is they got the firing part good. It's the barrel. The barrel would get really hot after so many rounds of, and they couldn't cool it down. The barrel would start to bend, get literally red hot. Well, finally, a guy named Gatling solved the problem by using multiple barrels. And that wasn't really perfected till the last part of the war itself. But so many different inventions were actually developed by the Civil War. Some simple, like hand grenades. Others, like landmines, more complex.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Richard, we got to take a break right now, so we will continue with this after the break. You're listening to Ghost Chronicles Book of Shadows with Marla Brooks and Ron Kolick, and our special guest is Richard Sennett right here on TojiNet Radio, brought to you by Circles of Wisdom, 286 Merrimack Street, Methuen, Massachusetts, the Glant Messier Family Law Group, 15 High Street, North Andover, Massachusetts, and our good friends on Ghost Chronicles Radio on Patreon. Become a member and get the access to over 50, 60 videos or something that are exclusively to our things. We'll be right back.
Do you have a paranormal event, book, or something else you want people to know about? Then why not advertise it on Ghost Chronicles Radio? With over 150,000 downloads a month, get your message out to an audience that's interested in the subject. We have a plan at a cost that fits your needs. For more information, contact Ron Kolick at anyghostproject@comcast.net or call 978-455-6678.
Located in Illinois, there lies a sleepy little town where nothing is a common occurrence.
You going to that party in town tonight?
Heck yeah! I only turned 18 once.
That is until the night of celebration.
Where the hell is she? Oh, no. No, 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 Jessica!
What's happening?
From the creators of Shadowhunters, Bite Me, comes a tale of primal terror and grindcore mayhem. Shadowhunters, kill Jessica, kill!
Can you hear me? My name is Harry Price. I am speaking to you via the medium of the Ghost Box. Many of you will know I carried out the first live radio broadcast from Haunted House way back in 1936 for the BBC. Now, thanks to the wonders of modern technology, I am still able to keep abreast of 21st century ghost hunting by listening to Ghost Chronicles International on TogiNet, ParaX Radio, The Ghost Channel, and even on something called a podcast. Two splendid chaps host it. One is an American who calls himself New England's own Van Helsing, although I have discovered his real name is Ron Kolek. The other is Stephen Parsons, and he's a paranormal scientist. Well, mustache, I'm required elsewhere on something called a K2. But don't forget, I'll be listening in every Tuesday from 8 o'clock in Great Britain and 3 o'clock on the American Eastern Seaboard. I trust you will join me there.
Thank you.
And welcome back to Ghost Chronicle Book of Shadows with Van Helsing, Ron Kolick. I'm the co-host, Ron's favorite West Coast witch, at least he says I am, Marla Brooks. And our guest tonight is Richard Sennett. Excuse me?
Until I find a better one.
Shame on you.
It happens.
You would miss me.
It happens, you know. It's like old girlfriend. You think she's the best until that
somebody better comes along.
Just kidding, Marla. You'll always be a special spot in my heart.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, speaking about that, we have a guest.
Yes, we do. Talking about hearts and stuff. I you know, Ron, you were talking about cryptids earlier.
I did.
But did you know the story about Bigfoot being seen at Harper's Ferry?
Really?
Ask the expert.
Was he getting on board or getting off? Harper's Ferry. Was he getting on board or getting off?
Richard, tell him about the Bigfoot at Harper's Ferry.
Yeah, I really did that one well. Okay, carry on.
Well, oddly enough, a lot of sightings of cryptids, monsters, did occur in the Civil War, from lizard men to the Bigfoot critter. He was seen reported in Harper's Ferry by the Union Army, where he attacked a group of soldiers and burst into their commissary and took a lot of their food and walked away with it, and it left big footprints. The private who saw the thing actually reported it to his officer, who didn't believe him, who went out after the creature with a company of men, but never saw it. But the reports were there. So there had been sightings of the Bigfoot, and not only there, but in Missouri and other parts of the battlefields of the Civil War. So Bigfoot was represented, and even UFOs were seen, as well as other monsters in various rivers of Arkansas. Well, the one UFO story I've got is that a group of recruits in Massachusetts were sailing to join a regiment. And as they were on the boat going down one of the little rivers in the New England area, they actually saw three lights in the sky. And they noticed that it was red, white, and blue. And they, of course, immediately took it to be angels or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, look, red, white, and blue, God must be on the side of the Union. And this is what it's all about. They interpreted everything in the terms of their era, through religion or through things that were known. When they saw something in the air, they immediately assumed it must be a balloon or something of that nature. So they saw things through their own lens, as we see ours through our own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we actually had a psychologist on the show, the last show, and we were talking about that, how we perceive things differently. Mm-hmm. So is there a particular story that's your favorite in there, or did they all just it's always a hard story?
There's a lot of weird stuff happened in the Civil War. One of the things that people have to remember is that the Civil War just didn't end when Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox Courthouse.
Nope.
In fact, it took months before it ended. They were the surrender of the various battlefield groups, armies in the field, whole states.
Texas.
In fact, it lagged for a long time. In fact, the new president of the United States, Andrew Johnson, didn't declare the war over till 1866, almost a year after the fighting. There were even battles being fought after the Appomattox, where Union and Confederate troops fought, and where Lincoln was assassinated. Oddly enough, the war was still going on, and I thought that was rather interesting. One of the most interesting thing was called the Dahlgren Raid that nobody talks about, and the Dahlgren Raid was this Colonel Dahlgren, who was a cavalryman, was given orders, special orders, to take a group, sneak into Richmond, Virginia, through a surreptitious route, capture the city, kill Jefferson Davis and his whole cabinet, release all the Union prisoners held there, and burn the city to the ground. Unfortunately, the plan failed, and Dahlgren was killed by a group of old men and young boys who were in the local militia, and they found on him a letter. And though the letter was unsigned, it was believed to have been written by Abraham Lincoln himself, ordering him to kill the president of the Confederacy. Hmm. And of course, Jefferson Davis got the letter, and he had it published in all the newspapers. And of course, the Union denied it, said it was obviously a fabrication. But at the end of the war, Stanton, the Secretary of War, he ordered that the records of the Confederacy be searched and that letter be found and brought to him and shown to no one else. Of course, they did, because Lincoln had been assassinated at that point in time. And he got the letter and it mysteriously vanished. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't exist to this day. Now, was it in Lincoln's handwriting? Did Lincoln order that? And of course, now he's the assassinated martyr president. They didn't want to tarnish his image by saying that he may have done that. And it may have fueled the reason why Lincoln himself was assassinated. Sort of like people believe that moves to assassinate Fidel Castro by CIA may have prompted the assassination of Kennedy. As kind of, the one move failed, but Kennedy fell to Castro's plot. Anyway, that's a great mystery about it. And there's so many others, like many of the people who witnessed that assassination went and fell due to odd circumstances, went mad or died strange ways, like Lincoln's wife, who went mad afterwards. All sorts of bizarre stuff occurred to all the people in that box who witnessed his assassination. A lot of interesting stuff about the death of Lincoln and what happened. And there seems to be a lot of things missing, like Booth's diary, where 13 pages were ripped out. Now, no one knows what they said. People did say that Booth did boast that he had 50 supporters, people whose names you would recognize, who were backing up the plan to kidnap Lincoln and later assassinate him. But who were these 50 people? Did they include high government officials? Were they just Confederate people? We don't know. So there's so many myths we still don't know about the Civil War. Heck, we don't even know who killed Kennedy. That happened just a few years ago within memory. Then we have this mystery back in 1865 that we were just at a loss to explain.
Yeah, I heard that Trump did it, but I could be wrong.
Yeah. Talked about one of his ancestors. Yeah. Or maybe he has a time machine.
Yeah, it could be. Well, yeah, that hair is going to last forever.
Yeah. He's going down strange with that. Maybe he went back in time and killed Christ on the cross. He gave
probably. We blame. No. We love the conspiracies. We love to talk about that type of stuff. So.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. It's the only sad thing is so many times the conspiracy theories prove to be right, or at least partially right.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing that, like your book is, it sorts it. So, which is interesting. A lot of times we just hear one side or another, somebody will write a book and they'll say, oh, this is it. Or somebody will take another book and write out that this is the opposite. Da, 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 da. But, if you put on both sides of it, it gives it a much more intriguing read to me, anyways.
And the stories. Go ahead.
what I find so fascinating is the way the Confederacy treated Native American people. And they treated them very well. For instance, they gave them citizenship. Technically, Native American people in the Confederacy could vote and could and had representation in the Confederate Congress. And many of the tribes in what was called Indian Territory were promised that if they fought for the South, and if the South won, they would be given the right to have their own state where Native Americans could vote. Of course, they had to own slaves, of course, but they did, so it wasn't a big challenge to them to do that. They treated them very well, by the way, but they did have slavery. But the idea was to make a whole new state where we now have Oklahoma, and it was to be called Sequoia. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. But they were very loyal to the South, and the very last general to surrender in the Civil War was Standing Waite, who was a Cherokee, and he surrendered at the very end of the war. So, in fact, thinking about that is the highest rank any African-American ever received in the Civil War on the Union side was Master Sergeant. Mm-hmm. Yet the highest rank that a Native American was given was a general. So it was kind of, they had a different respect. Now, history of the world would have been very different had the South won the Civil War. They could very well have moved west and treated the Native people far more humanely, oddly enough, than the Federals did later on. It's kind of an interesting thing, one that they never really talk about. And I was intrigued why Native people would fight for the South. Well, they had good reason to. They were promised a lot. Now, whether the South would have done it, I don't know. But they didn't get that opportunity. So it's an interesting little side note that people don't often talk much about. But everything gets boiled up in the subject of slavery. And slavery was on the way out, no matter what happened. Who won the Civil War? It was over with. Most countries on earth had abandoned it. Robert E. Lee himself freed his slaves because it was just not practical. Just from an economic point of view, it was just not a good system. It just didn't work very well. Besides being immoral, it was just economically not sound. So consequently, if the South had won the Civil War, odds are very great that the slaves would have all been let free after not too long after any victory.
Well, okay, so if the Native Americans were being treated very well and stuff, what about the Tecumseh Curse?
Well, that came much earlier, and that happened more in the northern part of the country where Tecumseh was from. He was a Shawnee, and his brother put the curse on, not Tecumseh. His brother was a religious man called the Prophet. And he had been lied to, again, by the American government. And after the Battle of Tippecanoe, where the Native people were defeated and massacred, really, at the end of the battle, he put the curse on the president, Harrison, who was running for office. And he was elected with John Tyler, who was popular, so his saying was Tippecanoe and Taylor too, and he was elected, but he only served 3 months. He got sick and died, and then every president elected in a year with a zero died and was assassinated in office, or just died, except Reagan. Reagan was shot. He avoided the curse. Maybe he ended it. I don't know. But every year after that, you getting elected in a year with a zero meant you would not survive the presidency. Anyway, that's the curse of Tecumseh. And it's been active, but not so much active today. As I say, Reagan was badly wounded, but he survived.
Right, because in 2000 and also to 2010 and 2020, we still had.
Yeah, George Bush survived two assassination attempts. And mm-hmm. I like the end that Richard wrote. He says, 2020, Joe Biden, scandal-ridden term. Will he survive the Tecumseh curse?
I think the odds are he won't, mainly due to his age more than anything else. So I think he'll be taken out. He's like one stroke away. And he's already had strokes, has health problems. So it's not really a good guess that he probably won't serve out the rest of his term.
And that's,
if he's reelected, he may not serve the end of it either.
But, you know, we look at statistics and we look at certain things and we bring out these facts and we try to correlate them like thing. You know, the whole Kennedy-Lincoln thing, if you look, go through that whole list of things, you know, the comparisons and so forth, you know, it's interesting. But it's one of those things that, you know, sometimes it's just a thing. It's not really anything that you can base on any type of, science.
That's part of what crypto history is all about, is looking at the kind of the supernatural side of things, or these curses of beliefs. There's a big tradition that Lincoln was cursed. And one story I got was from Arkansas. A lady lost her husband and sons in the Civil War. And she was a witch woman, and so she made a wooden dummy of Lincoln, and dressed him up and did a ceremony over him, and then drove a nail into his head.
Ouch.
According to the story, anyway, that was the same spot where Bruce's bullet went into the president's brain and killed him. So it's a great story. Is it true? I don't know. But it's... those are the little yards that men do about wars of these violent things that happen.
So, Richard, when you wrote this book, it's a great deal of detail in it from just talking with you. I mean, how did you research it?
Oh, all kinds of research. That took years to do. A book usually takes 2 years to do. Now, I had already done a lot of reading on the Civil War before because I really loved it. I had quite a library, you know, Shelby Foote and all these others. But I do tell people, if you want a book on the Civil War, this isn't your book. Yeah, read the so many others, thousands out there that talk about the battles and the statistics and the various generals and moves and stuff like that. I wanted to go after the unseen part of the Civil War, the folklore, the superstitions, the beliefs, the oddball stuff that happened out there, the crypto history, these yarns, are they true? Are they false? What are they based on? And so I would say get a good book on the Civil War and read it, and then pick up my book and then read it and see what you agree with and what you don't agree with as well. And I'm sure there's lots that you could find in error, but do look at it and give me your opinion. I feel free to open up my website and just let people say, yeah, I think that's wrong, or I think you're full of BS. But at least think about it. And that's what the book is designed to do, to get people to think, to evaluate, and not just accept the common thing. Oh, well, Lincoln surrendered. Everyone went home. That was the end of the or Lee surrendered, so that was the end of the war. No, it wasn't. And the many ways the war is still being fought. Sad to say, many of our problems we have today stem from that terrible war.
You know, I find that fascinating because we do have these perceptions that, you know, like, for instance, I love the Civil War myself. I have a ton of books on, but, you know, we talk about, you know, the naval history of the Civil War. We, you know, they bring about the ironclads and, you know, and maybe the surface race a little bit. We think, you know, we don't really think about it, but I have a book from the Library of Congress. That book is 4 inches thick. If it's anything, it's going to be even more than that. And it has every single naval conflict in the entire war. And you look at it, and it's so much there that we don't know about. You know, it's the hidden history of the war. It's not just the Monitor and the Merrimack. It's, you know, it's not the Alabama. It's, you know, it's so much details that we don't know about. And that's what this type of book has. It has the stories that you really don't hear about. And I find that intriguing.
Many people believe the South lost when New Orleans fell to the Union because it was one of their major cities and one of the places. But the bad thing is the whole destruction of New Orleans and its fall was pretty much decided because of their arrogance. They decided to build two ironclads, not one, to defend the city. And rather than use like the Merrimack and convert it into an ironclad, they decided to build it from scratch, even though they had no shipwrights or anything to do it. They'd use carpenters or what have you. And then they got into such a feud between them that the workers got on strike. Went on strike, stopped working because they wanted a dollar more an hour for their work, dollar more a day for their work. And because of that, the ironclads were unfinished when the Union showed up. Mm-hmm. They didn't have anything but a bunch of gunboats to defend the city. Nice. And they, of course, were all just scattered by the Union fleet. And the ironclads won. They put in place as a moored floating battery because the engine parts had not been received from Richmond. Right. And so it stood there. Now, it did fire a couple of rounds, and the armor worked to protect what was there, but it couldn't move. And so as such, it was worthless. And so if they had worked on just one ironclad and finished it in time, they could have actually defended the city. But as such, there were no defenses, and the city fell.
Right. And I mean, there are many errors like that, even in the Battle of Mobile with Faraday and, you know, damn the torpedoes. The ironclad, the Confederate ironclad there was actually a formidable ship, but they had made an engineering flaw where they had put the steering chains outside of the armor, and that's what really killed them in. The chain broke, and it couldn't navigate, and that was pretty much it.
Yeah, it would have one of the better ironclads, better 6 inches of armor rather than four. And it was a very good ship. In fact, the Union actually took it over after the battle and rebuilt it and used it to help capture Fort Morgan. But no, there is a good story I looked into, and there's a lot of evidence for it, that the only ironclad sank in the battle was a Union Monitor that hit a mine. But all the mines didn't go off. Remember the Admiral Farragut, full speed ahead, damn the torpedo.
Yep.
Well, after going full speed ahead through the minefield, the mines were actually ticking, hitting the ship, but none of them exploded. So the question is, how come the one ironclad that strayed into the minefield blew up? That it was lucky that it just hit that one mine that happened to be not waterlogged and blew up? Or were they all waterlogged? Well, it's a theory that the Confederates had a submarine there that it may have taken out the ironclad.
Oh, that's interesting. I never heard of that.
Yeah, in fact, they did a study of the wreck monitor, and they found next to it another ship, but they don't know what it was, and they refuse to dig it because it's a grave site, and we don't know. Well, one of the guys...
Unfortunately, Richard, we have run out of time, so I have to stop you there. Do you have your website? What's your website so that if anybody wants to find out more about you, they can?
Okay, I'm on Facebook, Richard Sennett Ghost Hunter. All my books are on Amazon.com, and there's an author's page. You can look at all of my books and my life story and everything else. but it's Amazon.com. And do buy it. I think you'll enjoy it.
Okay. All right. Anyways, we've been listening to Ghost Chronicles, Book of Shadows, right here on Toad Jeanette, brought to you by Circles of Wisdom, 286 Memrick Street, Methuen, Massachusetts, the Glant Messier Family Law Group, 15 High Street, not the Andover, Massachusetts. And our very, very good friends on Ghost Chronicles Radio on Patreon. Become a member from there, $3 a month. And you can quit anytime and you get access to over 60 videos. So thank you, everyone. Thank you, Richard, Marla as well. Good night and God bless.
Good night.
Ghoulies to ghosties, long-leggedy beasties, and things that go bump in the night. Deliver us, good Lord.